What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna make a scene, baby, me and you. On my rocking bicycle that's built for two. And thanks for tuning in today to Out There. It's Wednesday. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. For today's show, I have a couple of little stories that I'll work in somewhere. And last week, I played half of an interview with Hima Priya, who's a researcher from UMass, talking about a study that she did over the past year with a co-researcher about what people who identify as Black and who identify as white think should be done in the struggle for racial justice and how to prioritize things. Last week, I only got to play half of that interview, and I promised the other half this week. I might replay the entire interview for this week. It's about 26 minutes long. And then also, I have an interview with Niall Gangler of Pioneer Valley Frameworks at the Eastworks building in East Hampton. He's a frame builder and bike fitter, and he talks a bunch about like bike fit and the bike fit machine that he has and how important it is to have a bike that actually fits you for your comfort and your efficiency. I'll start with this little story that my friend April, who visited this morning for breakfast, told me. This is from a few years ago. So when she was living in Conway, involved with Natural Roots Farm up there, there was this turtle. She met it one day when she was washing her clothes in the river, and she picked up her clothes and the turtle had crawled under it. It was this three-toed wood turtle. They said it was like 70 or 80 years old, and it had been radio tagged. But anyway, when Hurricane Irene came in August of 2011, this turtle ended up in Hartford, and then by the next spring it was back in the South River in Conway. Go figure. Amazing animal story of the day. What else? I'm gonna start playing this interview with Hima.
So my name is Hima Priya.
And how did you get involved in this research study?
So I'm a PhD student at UMass Amherst, and so we're encouraged to do a lot of research projects. So this is one of my projects. I'm trying to understand what are the different perspectives that people have on the role of white people in a movement for black lives. And so our participants are both white and black people who identify as racial justice activists or who have been involved in efforts to address racial issues around the Western Mass area. So some of them are students and some of them are community members.
So yeah, that's how we met, is because I saw a flyer for Hima's study and I replied to it. And I like the study experience so much. I was like, I just want to know what other people say and what the results are of the study. So when did you start interviewing people or having people do the sorting task, or this, I don't know how you call the project.
Yeah, so the first task is a sorting task, and then there's a brief survey afterwards. When did we start? I feel it was more than a year ago.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It was like a year ago when I did it.
Yeah, so I think you were one of the first few participants to do it. It was more than a year ago, and I feel like the progress has been kind of slow. It was difficult to get participants at some point, and so it's also a pretty big commitment because we want people to come into the lab or meet us and then do this huge sorting task, and so sometimes it was difficult to get participants, and these are people who are involved in efforts, and so obviously that's more important to do things on the ground than to participate in a study. At least that was my perception, so I was always thinking, like, this is a favor that they're doing for us. So I guess it was more than a year ago, and then a few months ago is when we decided to stop data collection and start analyzing to try to understand, okay, so what are the perspectives that we are finding?
Uh-huh. Yeah. How many different people did you interview?
interviews, not, do you have a word that you would use?
I guess I would just call them participants. Yeah.
Okay, how many different participants did you get? And where did, and how did you get them? Where did you find them?
So flyers was one big thing. We tried to attend meetings. So we went to the Surge meeting, that I guess the Surge chapter in Western Mass, and tried to distribute flyers there to get people in, to let people know that we were doing this and we wanted to hear their perspectives. And so people contacted us through that. And also through the school, because there's a lot of activist groups on campus, so we try to recruit through there as well. Mm-hmm. So participants could contact us. Yeah, so we kind of just put the word out there and then got people to contact us. So we in total got, let's see, we got 33 white Americans and 22 black Americans. Mm-hmm. So we were only recruiting people who self-identified as white or black. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are other perspectives to include as well, but to start off so that we could specify the kind of groups that we want to, that the groups that we want to target. So we specified black and white, because that seems to be the debate now. It's like, so how do you get white people involved in a movement for black people? And so it seemed a good place to start before we move on to other Asian minority groups.
I want to take a minute to say, I think I mentioned this to you at one point, something about like the language of that, like a movement for black people. Mm-hmm. Because as a white person, identify as a white person, mm-hmm. Like the pain of racism is, like, sometimes I think white people are numb to it. Mm-hmm. But it's also a movement to help white people be whole, mm-hmm. as well. But I think that's sort of like a linguistic. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's like a linguistic thing. Language affects how we think about things as well, too. But
so we're kind of labeling the movement or the effort as something already.
Anyway, you have to do something, and you do the best you can. But I just wanted to like bring that up.
Yeah.
So the sorting task, like when I did it, there's like 60 cards. I just want to talk about, can you describe the task a little bit?
Yeah, so our first step is kind of just looking at a bunch of books and literatures and activist blogs to try to create statements that would reflect a variety of different roles that white people can take as allies to a movement for racial justice. And that's how we ended up coming up with 61 different statements. And so it was trying to be really all-encompassing, to be everything from learning to taking part in protests to interpersonal interaction. So we tried to be like, okay, so this is a bunch of different things that white people can do. And so that's how we ended up with so many statements. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of some of the specific cards, because I know there were some. If you have an example, that'd be great.
Our feet saved it. Oh, my God.
We dropped the computer. Because I know there were some cards. Mm-hmm. I would look at them, and I would look at the other one. I like, is this more important? Is that more important? And I would just go around and around in circles in my head.
Yeah, it was a difficult task for a lot of people.
It was very thought-provoking. I really, really appreciated that. It just made me think about my beliefs and why I think one thing is more important than another. And mm-hmm. and it made me want to... It just made me really want to understand the issues better and mm-hmm. other people's perspectives, particularly black people's perspectives. Because mm-hmm. I found myself being like, well, I think this is more important, but do I really know what mm-hmm. my black friends or allies think?
Yeah.
And of course, everyone's different, too.
Right. And one of the things that people told us during the data collection phase is that it's really hard to sort this because everything is important. And so we really force people to prioritize. So what is the top three that you think is the most important? And then slightly less important, slightly less. So, it was anchored on the most important to the least important. And so we really force people to prioritize these different things. So, yeah, these are some examples.
Okay. So here's some examples. Learn about the history of whiteness and racism, or learn about what black people want from white people's involvement in the struggle for racial justice, or participate in classes and seminars and discussion groups that focus on racial issues, be aware of white privilege in different contexts, avoid taking up too much space during protests for racial justice, stand behind, like physically stand behind black people during protests for racial justice, always follow nonviolent strategies, even if black people do not. Avoid talking to people in the media during a protest and instead direct media attention to black leadership. Intervene when witnessing racial prejudice or discrimination, for example, jokes, conversations, or actions. Boycott products or services that are racist. Vote for political candidates and support policies that advance racial justice. Sign online petitions. Anyway, so these things go on and on, you know, the realms of friendship and interpersonal interaction and personal education and political action.
Yeah, and some things are actions and some things are more like avoiding things. Some things are more inside you, like trying to confront your personal biases, and some things are really about intervening or calling things out. So we try to be as encompassing as possible. And on the survey that participants filled out after the sorting task, we always asked, so is there anything more to add? And most people said, nope, it was pretty... I can't think of anything else to add. That's good, yeah.
What was one of your favorite things about doing this task with participants?
So, although people struggled to to sort it, I really enjoyed hearing the feedback as they read through each statement, because we really encourage people to talk about it, you know, as they're sorting, what's the thought process like. And so I really enjoy doing that. Some of the studies that we've done for research, we don't even get to see the participants because they are sometimes online participants. So we just put the survey out there, complete it, and then we get the data back. And it's so impersonal. And that can be good for some reasons, but for a study like this, I really appreciated hearing people's feedback about it. It was really humbling. And yeah, and I think gave me a chance to get to know the participants like you. Yeah.
Were there any surprises for you? Or wait, did you do this? Do you have a collaborator?
Yeah, so my collaborator is Melis, and she is an expert on this type of sorting task. And the research method is specifically called Q methodology. And so she's an expert on Q methodology, which involves coming up with a bunch of statements and then getting participants to sort them. So this idea of trying to get a holistic representation of various perspectives on anything. So you can kind of adopt this methodology to study different perspectives about current social issues, and then you pick specific issues to study. So she really helped me develop this project.
Mm-hmm. So were there any surprises for either of you?
I would say a surprise is really the variability in how participants approach the task. So some participants completed it in like 20 minutes. So they were super fast and they were like, yep, I'm very clear about my view of these things. And then some participants really struggled and took up to an hour or more.
Yeah, I think it was on the hour end.
So that was interesting to me, like the thought process of participants and maybe additional constraints. So maybe the people who sorted really fast, maybe they just had another class to go to or something else to do that we didn't maybe get them at the right time, or they were really clear about their view. So sometimes it's still difficult to understand people's thought process, even though this was more intimate than other studies. Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, that hour that I spent sorting and stuff, I mean, that was an educational process in itself. Like, I learned things as I went along, which would then maybe make me want to shuffle the order I'd put something in.
Yeah, exactly. So it can be a fun task, and sometimes when we get participants who are students from the student pool, I think they also vary in how much they identify as an activist and how interested they are in something like this. So maybe that's another factor or another confound that could influence our results. Yeah.
So did you find any pattern of different results from people in different categories? Did you have any other categories besides black and white?
No, we did not.
Okay.
Yeah, and another surprising thing, I guess, is that we got almost all women. I think there were only three men in our participant pool. So I'm not sure if that is representative of activists in this area. But yeah, most of our participants were female. And we didn't find differences based on whether participants were black or white in trying to identify the different perspectives. So it seems like each perspective that we saw, there were both black and white participants who endorsed it to a degree. So that was also surprising to me. But as we, as I talked about it more with Melis, my collaborator on this project, we thought, you know, maybe this is a sampling thing. Maybe in our specific community, we can find people who endorse these different views. And since the different roles that we were investigating were all pretty positive, like none of the roles are explicitly negative or that would harm a movement, maybe. So that's why people in general agreed with it on both sides. So maybe they're not there's no conflict or debate there.
You're listening to an interview with Hima Priya, a researcher from UMass. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I'm going to play a song by Macy Gray and then come back for the other half of the interview with Hima.
Hey, white man, I am not my grandmother. I'm from the city, Canton, Ohio. I'm just a lady, but I think like a man. You hating me and I don't understand. You judging me, you wanna send me to hell. God is my father and I got my band. You come for me, let me make it clear. I whip your woo, woo, woo. I whip your woo.
That was Macy Gray. Now back to the interview with Hima Priya. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Valley Free Radio, and this is an interview. Hima did a research study over the past year asking people who identified as white and as black what they thought priorities should be in the struggle for racial justice.
Can you share some of the results, I guess, that you sort of this the categorizing and
yeah, for sure. So the way this data is analyzed, we try to extract factors or narratives that are unique. So definitely the factors that we extract is not going to be representative of all the, like, everyone who identifies as an activist. So this is based on the sample that we had access to. So we were able to find four distinguishing factors or narratives. So this four that we thought are kind of unique perspectives about what the role of white people are, white allies are. So the first one is really focused on trying to take actions actively. So these are actions that are that people do as individuals, so maybe intervening in racist situations or voting for candidates who are going to support racial justice. And it could also be more collective action, so participating in protests together for a cause. And the first factor was also emphasized that white people should be followers rather than leaders of a movement. And so it's important to listen to the perspective of black people and be responsive to it. So that's kind of the first one. The second factor seemed to be more interpersonal. So it was about interacting in a respectful way, trying to build safe spaces for black people. And it also focused on accountable relationships. So it seemed that this way of being an ally is through interpersonally being there for someone and supporting people. So I guess that's one specific difference. With factor one, it was more activist-y in a way, but with factor two, it's more, yeah, being there for your friends maybe who are black and trying to build that accountable relationship. And the third factor, to me, seemed like a really nervous factor because the ones that was really highly ranked as super important, according to this perspective, is trying to avoid anything that would indicate that you're dominating the efforts. Avoid taking up space, avoid being offensive, avoid speaking up when it's not your place to speak up. So this factor really focused on being careful not to dominate the efforts for racial justice. I guess that's something that came across that was different from the other factors. And the last one, factor four, was really about learning, so lifelong learning, trying to take classes that would help you understand people's experiences and realizing also in learning that it's not black people's responsibility to teach you. So this perspective was about self-learning and seeking out those opportunities to learn. And while learning, trying to teach other white people as well about their responsibility for racial justice. So yeah, as you can see, like, all four factors are good, positive things, but they kind of differ in specific ways. And I think maybe it helps people envision, okay, if I want to help a movement, these are some of the things that people can do that are helpful. There isn't one prototypical activist thing. You know, you can do a bunch of things that's going to help advance a movement. Yeah.
When you introduce these factors 1 through 4, are they in any ranking order or just the four? They happen to be four. Did anything rise to the top in terms of getting valued more highly by the majority of people?
No, we aren't able to do that given our participants. So we would like to run a second study actually based on these four factors to then understand how strongly do people rank each of these perspectives. With the current analysis, we're not able to rank, for example, so how many people endorse factor one over factor two, which is more strongly preferred. So those kind of questions really can't be addressed with this data. It's just identifying, so these are the four. We don't know how people see how important these different four are, or maybe there's something that comes first before you do something else. So another way to look at these factors is in a stepwise way. So maybe in part one, for example, you focus on learning, and then once you're comfortable with that, then you focus on reaching out to other white people, for example. So that's another way to think about it.
Cool. What else?
I guess I have a question for you. you know, as someone who's studying this, I feel that a lot of the research that we do don't go back to the community. You know, we collect data from participants who are community members and, you know, just everyday people, and then we publish it in scientific papers, or we go to conferences and everyone is academics there, but it doesn't go back to the community. So I guess I was curious about, do you think people might be interested in these findings, and what can I do to share it with the community?
I think, well, for me, like, hearing the findings, it's no great, like, aha moment. It's all just as kind of complicated as it ever was. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoy hearing them and just really enjoy being, like, reminded of all these things. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate what you say about how it takes so many different kinds of people doing so many different things to make mm-hmm. a movement. Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's worthwhile to remind people of that. The research shows it takes many different kinds of people to make a movement. And in terms of, like, getting it out, definitely, like, it could people from Surge, like, it could be presented at a Surge meeting or shared at a Surge meeting.
Yeah.
I think people, that would be a nice kind of follow-up kind of thing to do.
Yeah. And also maybe getting people at different stages. So Surge are really, it's a group of people that are super committed already, but maybe there are also people who don't really see themselves as active, but then, if we point out to them that these are kind of the findings, so maybe a more general audience, not an activist audience, like, I wonder if they might be interested in it too, I don't know.
Yeah, I mentioned the Surge meeting because that's where I first got the flyer. I know people from there. That's where some of the respondents came.
Right.
But thinking much broader than that to general who might be interested.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if any religious groups would be interested. Mm-hmm. Like a social justice committee of some different churches.
Yeah. I remember I had a participant who said that they did a reading group in their church, which was focused around reading books that are related to social justice and racial issues and bias. And so, I could recontact some of the participants and see, like, hey, do you want to have a conversation about the findings? And then maybe that would be a way to share with their networks and their friends.
I wonder if the Gazette, the newspaper, have any interest.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that important to publish.
Well, you have to find a catch. For the story aspect.
But
I mean, the newspaper prints lots of things that are less important than this.
And since our participants are all from the Western Mass, so a local newspaper might be interested. Yeah, that's true. I have another question. So based on the study and your experience in it, what do you see as the next step that research can help address? Maybe, like, something that we need more findings on.
I'd be curious to see what white people think about how racism affects them.
Because
that might, I mean, I feel like if white people had a better understanding of that, it might be more motivating in a really heartfelt core kind of way for white people to realize the depths of the harm to everyone.
Nothing really comes to mind about research on that. It always seems to be about making white people realize the harm that racism has against racial minorities, but not really about themselves. It's always like other people need help, and so you need to help them, but not really on the self, like how
It's kind of funny, you know, different perspectives on that, because one perspective could be, oh, white people say, no, I'm a victim too. Mm. But another perspective is, you know, the savior mentality doesn't help anyone. It just like perpetuates the whole thing of we white people have the power and people of color don't. And I think that in the United States, like, racial dynamics are the way they are and have been for so many centuries that it's just like accepted as normal that there's, you know, like a certain level of, I don't know, if distrust you could say, or lack of true relationship, or these artificial boundaries that people accept. And just this, you know, we're taught that there's this difference that there's not. I think it's kind of funny that, you know, there's no distinct difference between what black people and white people said in your survey. Yeah. This is kind of another example of like, we're all kind of the same, you know?
Yeah, we are mostly on the same page, and then there are specific differences, but I think in general, there are more similarities than differences, maybe.
So, Hema, how did you get involved in this particular topic?
So it seemed that a lot of the research really focused on, okay, so why do people want to participate in protest, or why do people want to become activists, but nothing's really looked at, well, how can you be an activist, or what are the different things that people can do? So one of the goals of the project is try to lay out, like, the lay of the land, like, what are things that people are already doing, and how can we categorize it in some way? Can we come up with a way to show that these are the different perspectives out there, what a way to be an ally? Yeah, so it's trying to fill a gap in the literature, and something that that I was interested in that way. Yeah.
Do you define yourself as an activist? Would you define this work as activist work?
I've struggled with that. I see myself more of someone who's helping more on the academic side, because I'm not doing enough, and I always feel like, okay, maybe if I do more, then I can qualify myself as an activist. So if I was taking a survey and it was like, are you an activist? Yes or no? I'd be like, no, not yet. But I see my role in this movement or in this place as trying to shed light on the issues from an academic lens and trying to teach about it, hopefully one day, where I can talk about, like, stereotyping, prejudice, discrimination, and try to raise awareness about those issues in that way. And then research helps with that, because sometimes when you talk to people know about the issues, but unless you have statistics to back you up or you have the data, it might not change policy or that kind of thing. So my projects right now are still pretty small scale, because I'm still learning how to do research, but hopefully someday I'll do, like, I don't know, larger scale research that can help change policy or the way people think about things. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Hema Priya, a researcher from UMass. The interview was done in early February at Haymarket Cafe in downtown Northampton. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I'm going to play a song by Yusu Ndora, sorry for my pronunciation, and Nina Cherry, 7 Seconds.
This world, it has no concept of the tone, the skin is les raisons qui nous poussent de changer tout. J'aimerais qu'on oublie leur couleur pour qu'ils espèrent. Beaucoup de sentiments, de race qu'il faut qu'ils désespèrent. Je veux les gamins ouverts, des amis pour parler de leur peine, de leur joie pour qu'ils le fient. Des infos qui ne divisent pas, changer. Seven seconds away, just as long as I stay, I'll be waiting. It's not a second, we're 7 seconds away, or just as long as I stay, I'll be waiting, I'll be waiting.
Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Black History Month by honoring the voices of a revolution. From the Montgomery bus boycott to the Black Power movement to the fight for reparations, Pacifica was there.
Paul taught me about being proud because I was Negro. Then he sat down for hours and he told me about Negro people. You know, I read it in some books and never learned it in school. They don't teach it in history books. And he didn't talk to me as a symbol of a pretty Negro chick singing in a club. He talked to me about my heritage. And that's why I always loved him.
Legendary singer Lena Horne talking about how important Paul Robeson was in her early life from a 1966 interview on Pacifica Radio. The airwaves of Pacifica radio stations included some of the most important African-American thinkers, artists, poets, writers, speakers, and activists of the 20th century. To find out more, visit our website at pacificaradioarchives.org.
Wednesday nights, you might tune in to the warm heart of Africa to hear the funky, sinuous rhythms of Afrobeat. Or the pulse of Algerian rhyme music. Or the desert trance of Tuareg blues. Or township jive from Johannesburg. Or catchy soukous beats from the Congo. Those are just a few examples of what you might hear from 7 to 9 every Wednesday night right here on Valley Free Radio. Join me, your host, DJ Vinyl Scratch, on The Warm Heart of Africa, a celebration of African and Afro-diaspora music, culture, and history, delivered with a groove.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I got a couple of announcements I'd like to make. This week is winter school break, and at the Academy of Music, today through Friday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, at the Academy of Music in downtown Northampton. There's a film festival for kids and their adults. Each day, the presentation starts at 1:30 p.m. showtime. Doors open at 1 o'clock. And it's part of the Four Sundays in February Winter Art Series presented by the Northampton Arts Council and the Academy of Music Theater. It's free admission, but donations are encouraged. Today is Wednesday, so today's show is already done. So Thursday and Friday, there are two remaining shows. Also, on February 24th, that is this Saturday, Citizens for Race Amity Now presents Black History, Race Amity, and Other Traditions at the Jones Library in Amherst. It's a wonderful occasion to engage with others in the greater Amherst community on unity, diversity, and on healing the effects of racism. And also there's Celebrate Black History Month. We're celebrating African American History Month by hosting a free public forum on equity and inclusion. We'll be asking our panel this broad question: what can area business leaders do to generate greater shared prosperity? This is Tuesday, February 27th at noon at the Powerhouse East Drive at Amherst College. I'm going to play an interview with Niall Gangler from the Pioneer Valley Frameworks in East Hampton.
So maybe you could just introduce yourself and tell me about your shop here.
Okay, yeah. So I'm Niall, and I'm the owner and builder at Pioneer Valley Frameworks, and I build all fully custom bicycle frames right here in Western Mass. So every detail of the bike, from all the fit down to all the details of the mounts and everything, are all one-off custom and built for the individual customer.
What does one-off mean? I hear that expression in the biz.
One-off is just another way of saying custom, but so it's one of a kind. So each one is its own configuration to the customer. Uh-huh. Yeah, one-off, yep. Okay.
So when I walked in the shop today, I noticed this contraption looks kind of like a stationary bike. Can you come over here? Can you tell me about your bike fitting machine?
Yes. So this is a type of size cycle. It's called for bike fitting, and every bit of it is adjustable. So what I'm able to do is get the customers on this and in person, get them warmed up and pedaling away, and then can really dial in the fit down to the millimeter. And there's a whole science of how to set someone up and have them be as efficient and fast and comfortable as possible. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, really few people have gotten professional fittings on their bikes, let alone have a professional fitting and then have a bike built exactly to that. But it really is incredible, because it so much of how a bike performs and feels comes down to how you're fit to it. And most people, there's just so much to be improved upon. And I get customers in who are super experienced and been riding and or racing, you name it, for decades. And there's always stuff that we can improve upon.
So what are some of the different ways that you could adjust this this fitting sample bike that would change a person's posture or angles?
So many. And it's funny, because one thing that's just funny about bike fitting is the person on the bike. You know, when you're as a rider, you can really tell what feels right is faster and better. Your body is like, oh, I'm happy now. But it is actually very complicated. There's a lot of variables to get to a given fit. And you would think, you know, you have three contact points on the bike: your feet, your butt on the seat, your hands on the bars. And you would think you could kind of move things independently, but really everything affects another thing. And it really takes someone, a professional, looking at you and taking in the whole picture and doing all these measurements to, you know, get everything dialed, because even as if you're an experienced rider alone, it's really hard to, you know, move one thing mm-hmm. and not mess up other things, yeah. basically.
Yeah, all the angles.
So, everything moves. There's so much stuff.
So in this bike fitting bike, does it have any other name?
So this model is a position cycle. It's an amazing piece of equipment. It's really fancy. And I was hooked up, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago or more with it from someone who's a bike fitter and ended up shutting their business down. And he really hooked me up with uh-huh. this piece of equipment. Uh-huh. For me, a huge part of my process is the fitting and the design of the bike, because that's what makes the difference. So I put this fitting part of the phase is really important and also really fun, because the customer kind of gets a glimpse of what they're going to be feeling, because usually when you start, there's stuff to be improved. And by the time you finish, like consistently, the customer is like putting out a lot more power way more yeah. easily by the end with all the adjustments. And they're like, whoa, so this is what I've been missing.
Yeah, just this bike, this fitting bike, you can adjust the height of the seat, of course, and all the four front and back positions of everything that is affected by how a frame, by the size and shape of a frame, right?
Right, yeah, everything.
And the crank arm length is adjustable.
It's kind of fun because it doesn't really look too much like a bike, this fitting bike, and it's a little abstract. You know, people get kind of hung up of like, oh, I've always ridden this size bike, so they kind of go in thinking, oh, this is what I need. And it's fun with this fitting bike because you don't, as the customer on the bike, they don't know exactly, you know, what the top tube length and all that's going to be, because mm-hmm. a lot of the positions are kind of floating around in space on this bike, the fitting bike. So I'm able to, you know, get them exactly where they need to be and kind of free of what they already have set in their mind. Because mm-hmm. People can get really hung up of, oh, I think I need this thing. And so it just lets you get someone exactly where they need to be mm-hmm. be as comfortable and as fast as mm-hmm. possible. So
when someone sits on it, when they try it out, how do they know if, like, what feels good and what feels right for, like, a minute will feel right for 5 hours?
Yeah, and that's part of the challenge. You know, you're not outside riding. It's a stationary bike, and the fitting is, you know, so the fit, my process, typically, there's a part I sit down with the customer, we talk about, you know, what they want to do on the bike and all the kind of details. So there's this spoken part of the kind of bike interview, and then the fitting on bike part. And the fitting on bike part typically, you know, for a custom frame, usually doesn't take less than 3 hours.
Okay, yeah, so this is a serious process.
Yeah, it's a serious process. So
it better be, if they're going to buy a custom-made
right,
bike.
Yeah, so and I'm someone who's really willing to, like, take the amount of time, whatever amount of time is necessary to get it right, because that's what makes the difference. But yeah, so there is just stuff from experience, tricks that I have to use too, to ensure I'm getting good information from mm-hmm. them. Because, you know, some people are like, yeah, I'm not quite sure I feel the difference here.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, so it's a combination of customer feedback, going off actual, you know, numbers that there's a bit of a science to, and then just also some experience.
So people can get a bike fit whether or not they're getting a bike from you. Right?
That's right. Yeah. So this year, actually going to be offering more frequently fittings for people with existing bikes. You know, it's crazy how much money a lot of cyclists spend on bike parts and stuff and never get a fitting. And it's like, you can have the most expensive, fanciest bike out there, but the fitting is your connection to that machine and how well it's going to work or not. So a fitting, it's well worth the money. Typically, the fittings for customers with existing bikes, it's usually $250 is what I charge. It's a good deal considering the amount of time and equipment that goes into it. And
you
then
you spent at least 3 hours with
yeah
the customer.
Typically it really helps you get the most out of your bike and prevent injuries.
Yeah.
But when you're fitting to an existing bike, you do run into a lot of shortcomings of, you know, that existing bike.
Yeah.
But there is much that you can improve upon to get more out of your bike and more out of yourself as like a rider or athlete.
What's the best way for people to contact you?
So email is great. Is pioneer@pioneerframeworks.com. My phone is 401. I'm from Rhode Island originally, even though I'm all about Western Mass. But it's 401-633-2940. But yeah, email's the best because if I'm welding or out riding or something, I can't always get to the phone.
And there's a website. Your contact information is on the website.
Yeah, pioneerframeworks.com. Yep.
That was Niall Gangler. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. If you want to listen to archived editions of Out There, you can listen online at weatherbeard.com/out there. And I think there's like a podcast function where you can get notified when new shows get posted. Every Saturday, Bike Lab.
You want to learn to fix your bike? How to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it? Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Vengan al Bike Lab de Northampton, el taller de bicicleta. Aprende a arreglar tu bicicleta y a divertirte.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue. They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
I bike everywhere if I can. I like riding my bike in Brooklyn because it's super fast and you can see the park inside and you can see the city in a different way. It's just super fun. Yeah. Thanks.
And that was my friend Laura. Do I have anything else before the end of the hour? I think I'm just going to play Lauryn Hill. Everything is everything. Thanks for listening to Out There today here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM in Northampton.
And violin it from the beginning. My practice extending across the atlas. I begat this, flipping in together on the dirty mattress. You can't match this, rapper slash actress. More powerful than two Cleopatras. Bomb graffiti on the tomb of Nefertiti. MCs ain't ready to take it to the Serengeti. My rhymes is heavy, like the mind of Sister Betty. L Boogie spars with stars and constellations. Then came down for a little conversation. Adjacent to the king, fear no human being. Roll with cherubims to Nassau Coliseum. Now hear this mixture, where hip-hop meets scripture. Develop a negative into a positive picture.
Now everything is everything.
Sometimes it seems
we'll
touch that tree.